Now I'm going to jump just a little bit, and I want to move on to the 20th century. The end of the 19th century had seen some very significant struggles, in particular the struggle for women's rights. This is a picture of Girton College, which was the first college built in Cambridge University for women. Women were not allowed. It was very difficult for them, and they had to be very careful as well. They knew everybody was looking at them, and so they had very strict rules. You know, no sex. Very strict rules. But this was for women, mostly women. The people who went from the university, the men who went from university, were all from the elite. But the women were also from the elite, but they really wanted to study. And there was a series of struggles for women, for women's liberation. The one we all know more about is the right to vote, which is very important. Secondly, the right to education. Thirdly, the right to birth control. And fourthly, the right to own property. Until the 1870s, everything a woman owned belonged to her husband. There was no possibility. And in the 1870s, the Married Woman's Property Act made a difference. Now, these are interesting, these four different kind of campaigns. Some of them were small campaigns by influential women, and some of them were mass campaigns. And it's not difficult to understand. There was never a mass campaign to allow women into university. Most women had never met anybody, a woman or a man, who had been to university. So if you went to Manchester in the working class part of town and said, we're running a campaign so women can get into university, no, nobody is interested. Yeah, university is so, so distant. However, the right to vote, that was a mass campaign where you could get support in every part of the country, in every part of society. The other story, I don't know if I told you this story, I might have done, about the medical students, the women medical students. Did I mention this? The first women to study medicine in Britain was in Edinburgh. Did I tell you this story? No. Okay. And the first day they went to the lectures. There were six of them. And on the second day, the men came to lectures with pigs and dogs and goats. And they said, if we allow women, we should allow animals too. Now, it is a little funny today. You can imagine it was really not funny. And can you imagine how brave the women were to come back the third day, where after the men had, some of the men had brought animals the second day. So these were very, 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 very difficult, very, very aggressive campaigns. The end of the very end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, saw some campaigns around the question of homosexuality. Homosexuality for men was illegal. There were no laws about lesbians because the Parliament didn't want to talk about that kind of thing. Yeah, it really was. It was. And also, women's sexuality was not taken seriously. And so, you know, if there were stories about women sleeping together, it was just like, oh, well, you know, children will do silly things. You know, it was not taken seriously at all. However, the laws against homosexuality were very strong. And Oscar Wilde, the famous playwright, very, very funny, very, very funny playwright. He had a whole series of well-known sayings. For example, he's well-known for having said that there is only one thing worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. He came up with things like that, and he wrote a whole series of plays. He was thrown in prison for homosexuality. He was accused of being homosexual, and he was thrown in prison for quite a long time, and it ruined his health. So let's move on to the 20th century, and the key thing at the very beginning is the arrival of the Labour Party. The Labour Party is established around 1900. Have I got the date there? Oh, look, 1900, yes, that's good. Yeah, I knew it was around 1900. This is not surprising in a way. This is the same period after 1885, where you have the foundation of the French Socialist Party, the Italian Socialist Party, the Canadian Socialist Party, the Japanese Socialist Party. It's Socialist parties are founded across the world, except in the United States. Interesting. But in Britain, things are a little bit different. They found the Labour Party. It's not an accident that in Britain, unlike every other country in Europe, they're not calling it the Socialist Party, they're calling it the Labour Party. It's a more general idea. There are some socialists inside. In fact, the Labour Party is established by a coalition of trade union leaders, radical Christians and socialists, some of them being Marxists. Perhaps you remember that Karl Marx lived in London for the last 20-odd years of his life. So the establishment of the Labour Party. Now, the reason for this was that after 1884, most working men got the votes. That's right, yeah, most working men got the vote after 1884. I already mentioned that, that's why I remember it. So there was a need for a party which would represent working people. The Liberal Party was not very successful like that, so the Labour Party was established. After 1918, the other thing that changed in 1918, if I remember correctly, is that members of Parliament received a salary. This is extremely important, because if you don't have a salary, only rich people can be members of Parliament. Here you have one of the early posters of the Labour Party. Vote Labour, and you can see that what's happening is that they're all stood on a ladder, and the man at the top, the rich man, says, let's have equal sacrifice. Everybody move down one step. And of course the unemployed man, if he moves down one step, he will be drowned. Yeah. This is what this poster is saying is, you know, the other politicians are not helping the workers. You need to vote Labour for the workers. Under pressure from the Labour Party did not become the government until 1924. But there was a pressure from the Labour Party and the Liberal Party. They needed votes from the workers. And so they introduced some reforms in the Liberal government 1905-15. The first ever free school meals. There were a lot of hungry children at school. The very first old age pensions. This meant that for some old people, there was no longer a danger when you could no longer work of having to go to live in the workhouse. The first labour exchanges to help unemployed people get a job. And in 1911, the National Health Insurance Act. This act gave health insurance for only some workers, but for miners and railway workers, etc. Universal health coverage is much later in 1948. So here you have some reforms by the Liberal government. These were not the first in the world. The first in the world were in Germany, in Prussia, with Bismarck introducing old age pensions and things like that. But they were, you know, they were pretty early on, any case. And so the Liberal Party, under pressure, because of the existence of the Labour Party, began to make this kind of reforms. It was quite difficult for them to do so. You'll remember that the British Parliament is made up of the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And when they brought in some these social reforms, the House of Lords said no. And eventually the Prime Minister Lloyd George had to put huge pressure on the House of Lords in order to put these through. The campaign for women's suffrage, which had been going on for a long time, 1860 to 1914, the campaign for women's suffrage. That's 54 years. Il faut se les taper, les 54 ans de militantisme. They had a great... Now, the most famous of the fighters for women's suffrage are the suffragettes from 1904 on. But it's not the case that there was no success before. Before 1900... The women were given the vote for local elections and for school board elections. So the work it was happening, little progress was made. But in 1904, the Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughters, Christabel and Sylvia, and the other one, Adeline, I think so, they decided to establish a new organisation. This was called the Women's Social and Political Union. And the slogan was, anybody remember the slogan? Deeds, not words. Des actions, pas de mots. And they moved on to direct action. So what did they do? They burnt letterboxes. Les boîtes jaunes de la rue. That sounds a bit bizarre. At the time, remember, very few telephones, no internet. Every business in the country sent all of their checks and bills and things by post. It was very serious direct action, burning letterboxes. They burnt thousands of letterboxes. They burnt... Oh, yeah, the golf courses, yes, of course. The golf course is the sport of the elites. The race courses and so on. They invaded... It tended to get more radical as the years went by. They invaded the parliament at one point, and of course chained themselves to things and so on. And the centre of this campaign was shown by Emmeline Pankhurst, and somebody said to her, if you burn letterboxes and smash windows, you will not persuade people to support the right to vote for women. And Emmeline Pankhurst said, we are not trying to persuade anybody. We are trying to make political life impossible until we are given our rights. So she was saying, a very, very interesting idea. So she was saying, we've been trying to persuade people since 1860. We don't care if the government gives women the votes because the government is scared. That's fine. We don't care if we're not persuading them. We just want results. Yeah. And so this was the idea of direct action, deeds, not words, which certainly, probably, I would think, in fact, won the majority of the population to the idea that women should have the vote. Some people thought it is right for women to have the vote, and other people thought we will never have peace until women have the vote. Yeah, and Emmeline Pankhurst said, they're both good. Yeah, no problem, that's good. You can see this in, as you know, I wrote history books about a popular song in Britain, the history of popular song. And there are popular songs saying, women should not have the vote, it's ridiculous. And these popular songs are in 1880 and in 1890, and after 1900 there are zero popular songs saying women should not have the vote. And this is because in the British music hall, the popular songs, you must get everybody to sing with you. So you cannot propose songs which are not consensual. And so the fact that there are no songs after 1900 saying votes for women is ridiculous shows that it's no longer a very popular idea. You can see here a banner of the Northern Men's Federation for Women's Suffrage. These are men's organisations supporting women's right to vote. The suffragettes, although they did burn letterboxes, and they burnt a minister's house at one point, his secondary home. But they also organised much more traditional things like big demonstrations. The huge demonstrations in London, they were much more complicated at the time because, of course, microphones didn't exist. So what you had is you had a huge park, and every 100 yards you had a stage, and the speaker would come here and speak to 2,000 people, and then go 100 yards to the next stage and speak to 2,000 people, and another speaker would be following them round. Yeah? It was very, very energetic. You needed to really be able to make a noise. In 1914, the First World War broke out. I'm not going to go into detail about this, especially because a few of you have had a lot of detail about it. The women's suffrage campaign stopped. The Emmeline Pankhurst's newspaper was called The Suffragette. She changed the name of the newspaper to Britannia. And she stopped her campaign, and she campaigned for men to join the army. instead. She was a complete, a total, after the war she became a Conservative Member of Parliament. So certainly the British Empire was even more important to Emmeline Pankhurst than Votes for Women. Her family were divided. Her daughter Christabel agreed with her and they campaigned together for the war. Her daughter Sylvia was against the war and campaigned against the war in London right through the war. And her daughter Adelaine had the same opinions, but she was in Australia, so it was a slightly different. So the Pankhurst family was completely divided. But the suffragette campaign stopped. The First World War began. I don't want to go into great detail about this. At the beginning of the First World War, the army was a volunteer army. You joined because you chose to join. This was not exactly true. They went around the prisons and they said, you can leave prison if you join the army. So it wasn't exactly volunteers, but it was volunteers. This did not work. And 2 years later, they had to follow the French example and introduce conscription. If you're a man, you're obliged to join the army. The First World War was not fun. A British cemetery in France. Let's forget the First World War. I've been talking about the First World War all afternoon. Let's talk about the 1920s. Here are the big dates from the 1920s. The first Labour government in 1924. However, it was a minority government. It did not have a majority in Parliament. And so it could not bring in a large number of reforms. It did bring in an important reform in housing, which you can still see in Britain today, because they decided they were going to build cheap housing for poor people. And they decided it must be houses and not flats. And it must be houses with a little garden. Now, we often laugh at the English people with their little house, with their little garden. But in fact, it was a great step forward for most poor people to have this as an ideal. In 1926, the general strike was called by all the trade unions to support the miners. The employers had decided to reduce miners' wages, and all the trade unions joined in. This was a big deal. It lasted 10 days, the general strike. There were no newspapers except for the official government newspaper and the official union newspaper. The BBC became very important, because when there were no newspapers, it became important. The BBC had been started in 1922, the beginning of the BBC. You can see my lecture about it if you wish. The general strike was not successful. The strikers lost, but it's interesting. It left a big mark in working class communities. As you can imagine, at the time, in the mining villages, everybody was a miner. All the men were miners, just all of them. That's what they did. I was in Yorkshire in the 1980s, so a long time ago in the 1980s, and I was with a friend who was a miner, and he said, "Can you see that man over there? If he goes into the shops in the village, they refuse to serve him, because in 1926 he broke the strike." That was the atmosphere of the miners. And 50 years later, they wouldn't serve him in the village shops, because if you break a strike. Now, the reason for this, of course, is that in the mines, trade unions were a literal matter of life and death. That is, the mines where they had trade unions had much more safety than the mines where it was really, people regularly died in the mines, and people died much less if people followed the trade unions. So that's how strong it was, and still is in some places. The second Labour government was in 1929. All the Labour supporters had a big party in 1929. Ramsay MacDonald, the hero of the Labour movement, was now Prime Minister, the first ever socialist Prime Minister in Britain. And they thought that everything would change. When you are faced with a change you have never seen, you often exaggerate what's going to happen. And so, poverty will finish now. We have a socialist government. Now, The Labour government had some strong points and some weak points, but I think you will agree with me that if you are going to become the government, 1929 is not a really good date to become the government. The economy is about to collapse. Not because of the Labour government, but the Wall Street crash, 10 million unemployed in America, 6 million unemployed in Britain, also huge poverty across South America, which we often forget about, and across India, but we're talking about Britain. So the economy collapsed. So, you know, perhaps one might think that the Labour government of 1929, which didn't do very many important reforms, perhaps they had some excuse. In any case, it was a disaster for the Labour Party because Ramsay MacDonald, the Labour Prime Minister, he said, well, I know what I'm going to do because the situation is so bad. I'm going to join the Conservatives. So he said, we need a national government where we have Labour and Conservative together in the same government. Because he proposed this, he was expelled from the Labour Party. They had an election, and Ramsay MacDonald became Prime Minister of a national government. That is to say, most of his members of Parliament were Conservatives, and he was expelled from the Labour Party. This was the darkest night for Labour Party people. They had waited for decades and decades to have, finally, a socialist Prime Minister, and 2 years later he joined the Conservatives. Even today, if you talk to Labour Party people in Britain, don't say anything good about Ramsay MacDonald. They hate him. Si vous avez des amis communistes, vous leur parlez de Jacques Doriot. C'est dans les années 30, il le déteste. Il a quitté les communistes pour rejoindre les fascistes. Et on n'a pas oublié, voilà. Si vous le voyez, vous lui dites. Non, il est mort. OK. The 1930s then, unsurprisingly, because of the millions of unemployed, also gave rise to a large number of social upheavals. One example is that the fascist movement rose quite quickly in Britain. This was the British Union of Fascists, established by Oswald Mosley, and as you probably guessed, they are defeated fairly quickly. Nevertheless, they had meetings in football stadiums. Yeah, when they had a meeting in a football stadium. Yeah, so it was a big deal. It was a big fascist movement. And 1936 is a symbolic moment because the fascists, the British Union fascists, said, "Let's have a march to build fascism. Let's march through the East End of London." Does anybody know what is characteristic of the East End of London? What kind of people live there? It's the Jewish part of London. At the end of the 19th century, in 1880 and 1890, the most dangerous place in the world to be a Jew was Russia and Poland. And very large numbers of Jewish people came to Britain and lived in London, in a whole part of East London where everybody spoke Yiddish. And the signs were in English and in Yiddish. It was the Jewish part of London. And so the fascists said, hey, we'll have a march through the Jewish part of London. Obviously a huge provocation. Can you imagine Eric Zemmour organizing a march at Barbès Rochechouart in Paris and the Arab part of town? It was a big deal. Big deal. Fortunately, the local Jewish community and some trade unions and the Communist Party organized, and so when 10,000 fascists arrived, there were 100,000 protesters waiting for them. They couldn't have their march, they had to run away, and the fascists were demoralized for a whole number of years. Cable Street still today is a moment that left-wing people are very proud of. You remember, I'm a very old man. I wasn't there in Cable Street. But in the 1980s, I was in London, and we were going from door to door with an anti-fascist campaign. And we said, oh, hello, are you interested in the anti-fascist campaign? And I met a man, he said, I was at Cable Street And he told me the story of being at Cable Street. So Cable Street, a big symbolic moment there. I may have some pictures here. Oh, so here are the pictures going back. The government newspaper from the general strike. The trade union newspaper from the general strike. Ramsay MacDonald. Everybody had to have a moustache at this time. Oswald Mosley, the British fascist leader. You can see he has the uniform. If you look at this, you think, oh, it must be Italy. But no, it's London. There is a red plaque for the Battle of Cable Street. So this is interesting because this plaque is put there by the local government. So it's something which has, you know, establishment recognition to some extent. Yeah, a banner for the 60th anniversary, so you see people have not forgotten. I don't know why I've got Windsor. Oh, yes, of course. So, of course, the next thing which happens, as I'm sure you knew, is the Second World War. There is a period when the British government tries to avoid the Second World War. And famously, Neville Chamberlain, who is the Prime Minister, in 1937 or 38, he comes back from Germany and he gets off the plane in London and he sees the journalist and he waves a piece of paper. This piece of paper, signed by myself and Adolf Hitler, this document represents peace in our time. Donc je crois que fail, c'est le mot que vous cherchez. Yeah. So he thought it was possible to make a compromise with Hitler and therefore to avoid a second world war. Now, obviously, history has not been kind to him. He has a very bad reputation. There's a film that came out recently, I can't remember the title, just about this period, just before the war. In any case, that didn't work out. To be fair on Neville Chamberlain, because of course he has a very bad reputation, because he looks so, but of course, you know, a lot of people supported him. Some of his arguments were, it was 20 years since the end of the First World War. The First World War was now very unpopular. Many people in the 30s considered that the First World War had just been killing millions of soldiers just for the interests of bankers. It was a very, very negative thing. And so the British government was afraid. They said, if we have another war, the people might not support it. So they were very worried about this, because when you have a big war, when you have a total war, like the World Wars War, and the people don't support it, that's when you have a revolution. They have no option, yeah? That's what happened in at the end of the war. The Russian Revolution happened because the Russian people refused to continue the war. And there was also a revolution in Germany and Hungary and so on. So people were very worried. So in any case, it didn't turn out like that. It turned out it was possible to win the British people to support the war. However, the government, Winston Churchill and the government, had to promise a lot of things to people. They started talking about the welfare state. They started talking about free hospitals, free doctors. Well, after the war, things will be much better. And the Second World War then came into space. And Winston Churchill, of course, the famous and lucky politician who led it, extremely intelligent guy. I've not already spoken to you about Winston Churchill. I'm getting deja vu here. A very, very funny guy. Did I already tell you jokes about Winston Churchill? No. Okay. I must have told him something else. A very funny guy. Apparently, he liked to drink, and apparently, a lady friend said to him once, "Mr. Churchill, you are drunk," and he answered, "Yes, madam, and you are ugly, but tomorrow morning, I will not be drunk anymore." He's really a pretty vicious sort of guy to get involved with. Another one involves somebody saying, "Mr. Churchill, if I were your wife, I would put poison in your coffee. Madam, if I were your husband, I would drink it." A funny guy, that's not very important. But he was rather lucky. Because if he had died in 1938, he was quite old. His reputation was really bad. His reputation was being a very bad military leader during the First World War and sending the army to attack strikers in Wales. He had a very bad reputation in 1938. So he was rather lucky because certainly from a military point of view, he was a very good military leader. He was good. And so he was lucky enough to end up a hero. My mother has a bust of Winston Churchill in her living room, just to show. Do any of your parents or grandparents have a bust of General de Gaulle? Of Charles de Gaulle? No. Do they have a bust of anybody? Apart from religious things, maybe. Ah, that's interesting. Yeah, in Britain, Winston Churchill, the two busts you will see in working class homes in Britain, Winston Churchill, and who's the second? Definitely not. Because they were two, it's an age problem as well. So William Shakespeare. Yeah, William Shakespeare. You can just buy for 25p, you can buy a bust of William Shakespeare. That's not really important. It's a bit bizarre talking to you in Normandy about bombing towns, because things were five times worse in Normandy than they were in London. Nevertheless, the Blitz in London was very bad news. It was very bad news. A quarter of all the buildings were destroyed. The bombing of Germany was much worse. Because quite rapidly the technology of the British, with the help from the Americans, was superior. They had better radar, and so the number of people killed by bombs in Germany is far higher. The Blitz did cause a certain amount of social conflict, because if you live in London, as you can imagine, where would you hide? You'd hide in the underground. It's obvious. Hide in the underground. The government refused to open the underground at night for people to hide there. Because the government was frightened. The government was saying, if people go down, they won't come back up and work. They will stay down as much as they can and just come up back up from time to time to get some food. And of course, if the people don't come and work, you lose the war. You can only win the war by making more bullets and tanks and guns and ships and food and uniforms than the other people. If your people don't work, you've lost. And so this was a big problem. However, there was a campaign, partly by the Communist Party, to say, we demand that they open the underground so people can sleep in the underground. And they did open the underground. And so that was very good for them. Manchester. An aeroplane. Dresden. Just to be internationalist. Next time, Britain since 1945. Thank you for listening. That's enough for today. Remember that if you have an idea of some aspect of British history you would like me to revise in class, send me an email. Don't ask me in class. I can't invent it. I have to think.